We have a ton to touch on, as we always do. So I'm really excited to get our panelists' takes on recent data and how things are looking moving forward into the latter part of 2024. Now, those of you who have come to our spaces before know I like to keep the panels open for discussion. So if you have anything to add, as always, please do so. The only request that I have is that we keep microphones muted while others are talking, just to kind of avoid any overlap and any feedback from each other's audio. Now, with that said, as always, I want to hit it with some introductions first. And we'll start off here with Joseph Wang, welcoming him back again, our go-to Fed guy. And as many of you know, he headed trading at the Fed's Open Markets Desk, has a great introductory book on central banking called Central Banking 101, and has one of the best YouTube channels discussing the markets. Subscribe to that once y'all get the chance at FedGuy12 on YouTube. Welcome back, Joseph.
Hey, Nicholas. Thanks so much for having me. Love being on the show. And it's so great to see everyone else here. I always learn a lot on these podcasts. And honestly, today is going to be the most exciting Fed decision in some time. So glad to be here with all of you to see what happens.
And as always, glad to have you, Joseph. Thanks for coming again. Next, we've got another frequent friend of the spaces, Last Bear Standing, is an expert on markets where he writes about monetary policy in his weekly Substack. If you're not subscribed to that Substack, definitely go do that. A lot of good information comes out every time he publishes. Welcome back, Last Bear.
Thanks, guys. Yeah, we are potentially looking at a decision for the first time in some time. So it'll be interesting. Looking forward to the discussion here.
I think everybody is sharing that excitement. Thanks for coming, Last Bear. Next, we've got Michael Cao, the Chief Investment Officer and Portfolio Manager of Cao Family Office, and an expert in commodities, convertible and capital structure, arbitrage, and dynamic hedging. Sorry about that. My mic cut out as I was introducing the GOAT, Michael Cao. Welcome back, man.
Hey, thank you so much. I'm really grateful for always being invited to this. I view it as an opportunity to just, you know, check in every once in a while with people whose opinions I respect very much. So grateful to be here.
And I think I speak for everyone when I say grateful to have you, Michael. Thank you. Next, we've got our leading volatility expert and founder of Kai Volatility, Jem Karsan. They're launching a ton of new and innovative things in the coming months. As I've mentioned before, Vol Tools on the horizon, and check them out, everybody. Chem's another one of those that you're going to get a different take on a lot of the things that we sometimes get caught up in echo chambers on. You can also subscribe to Kai Volatility's Invaluable Market Newsletter. Welcome back, Jem.
Great to be here after a couple month absence. Great to check in. Really important moment for markets, not just because of the interest rate decision, but where we sit here in mid-September, election behind, end of year, and a big up year. A lot to talk about. Looking forward to it. Always love being here with all these guys.
Always love having you too, Jem. Thank you. And later, everybody, we'll also be joined by Danny Ives, someone you may all know with over two decades of experience in tech analysis on Wall Street, currently a managing director and senior equity research analyst covering the technology sector at Wedbush Securities. You've seen him on everything from CNBC, Bloomberg, and NBC to France 24, TV Tokyo. The list goes on. And we'll be really honored when he joins us later to give his feedback on our discussions today. So without further ado, let's get a quick macro overview here, as I always like to do, since our last FOMC panel space in July. Consumer price index for August came in at 2.5% year over year compared to an estimated 2.6%. And a large portion of the all items index rise stemmed from shelter, which rose 0.5% in August. The total non-farm payroll employment increased by 142,000 in August, while unemployment itself saw very little development, coming in at 4.2%. In addition to all of this, there were two major volatility events in the markets in August, one being the yen carry trade, with the third largest VIX ever, and then the vol around the Jackson Hole event. Talks of rate cuts, once again, as we all know, at the forefront of everyone's minds, with 50 basis points seeming to be the consensus, some possibly saying all at once today, and then some others, such as Elizabeth Warren, even calling for 75 or a higher basis point cut. And then on top of all of that, gold is yet again pushing to new high after new high. Now, to start us off here, Joseph, many are still saying that the Fed's policy has been too restrictive so far. Now, with cuts of varying estimated degrees on the horizon, does that sentiment hold true and rate cuts now are easing the overly restrictive policy, or was policy more or less appropriate to begin with?
Hey, that's a really good summation of the macro backdrop and a really good question. So ultimately, that question is just where is the neutral rate? The neutral rate being the rate where policy is neither restrictive nor loose. So the Fed wants to have that as a baseline so that we know whether or not policy is restrictive. Now, I think one of the things that's really interesting is that over the past couple of years, even though we hiked interest rates to multi-decade highs, say 5.5%, when you look at common measures of, let's say, financial conditions, like the equity markets, like credit spreads, things like that, it's hard to see financial conditions being really loose. And in addition to that, when you look at the macro data, you'll also notice that even though interest rates were at multi-decade highs, you know, GDP continues to grow above trend. And so it's really hard to know if financial conditions, when we are over the past few months, have been too tight. From my personal, it doesn't seem like there's a lot of evidence that's been the case. However, to your point, market is pricing in a lot of rate cuts in the coming months. Actually, the market is thinking that maybe the Fed will cut to below 3% by the end of December next year. And that all is already in the market pricing and is effectively easing policy. So when we look at interest rate sensitive sectors like housing in the US, we already see an uptick in mortgage applications. So if policy wasn't super restrictive beforehand, and now we're pricing a whole bunch of easing, I think you can make the good argument that we're actually on the cusp of some kind of re-acceleration on inflation and growth, simply because we misunderstand just what the neutral rate is and how policy is restrictive or not restrictive.
Thank you, Joseph. A lot to unpack there. Does anybody have any comments there specifically on what Joseph said about potentially more restriction as we kind of ease into lower rates? Go ahead, Last Bear.
Yeah, I was just going to add that we have to take into account the fact that the market is obviously forward-looking, and the Fed these days is also provides a substantial amount of forward guidance. So if we look at where, sort of peak tightness in the cycle was, I would say that that was all the way back in maybe October 2022. That was back when the Fed was hiking by 50 basis points. Inflation was still a big concern. It wasn't clear that it had necessarily started a consistent moderation. And there was still real uncertainty about exactly where rates were going to go and would they continue to, you know, climb higher than anyone's expectations. But since then, we've seen across a number of different metrics, whether it's credit spreads or actual all-in yields on things or the VIX or the stock market, loosening pretty consistently through this whole time since, which has been almost 2 years. And so I think that there has been a lot of easing already built in. And obviously, if you look at the forward curve on, you know, treasury rates or any sort of rates, they're accounting for the fact that, you know, the Fed has been guiding towards cuts for some time now. So I think that they're mostly following through on their forward guidance. And therefore, I think that as long as they sort of continue with that path, we may actually not see a ton of change in financial conditions as a result of this. So I'm maybe a little bit less concerned about the reacceleration just because a lot of that loosening has already been happening. And we've seen inflation continue to play ball for the most part. And we haven't seen acceleration in most of the macro data. We see growth, but clearly slowing growth. And clearly concern in the job market that I don't see any signs really of reversing at this point.
Thank you, Last Bear. Jem or Michael, anything to say to Joseph or Last Bear's points here before I move on? Michael, I see your hand.
Hi. I'll chime in. A couple of weeks ago, I wrote a piece called The Return of Pusillanimous Powell, and I'm going to henceforth refer to him as PP for short. And the reason why I call him Pusillanimous Powell is because I think that over the last several decades, Fed policy has inured us and inured the markets to this whole notion that there is such a thing as a business cycle. The business cycle has all been eradicated by Fed policy, where we can't tolerate a recession. We can't even tolerate a mild slowdown. And so I think I'm in the camp that thinks that the Fed is not too late. The Fed is too early in cutting, because too late, quite frankly, is what we need here to really break the back of inflation. And I will say that the reason why I'm concerned about a resurgence in inflation is that in my piece, I wrote that we really haven't seen this confluence of supply inelasticities over the last several decades, and I'll name them. So first and foremost, I pay a lot of attention to oil. There's an artificial supply inelasticity in oil driven by geopolitics and Saudi Arabia's decision to unilaterally support that market. There has been, although it's been easing somewhat lately, there's been a supply inelasticity in freight rates driven by geopolitical risk in the Middle East. There is a much stronger secular supply inelasticity. Supply inelasticity and manufacturing capacity in certain sectors, driven by geopolitical choice of nearshoring. We all know about the supply inelasticity in treasury bonds, driven by Treasury's deliberate QRA games to restrict the supply of duration, which is also stimulative. There is a structural undersupply and inelasticity in housing, which, by the way, is met by a demographically driven demand inelasticity, which, as Joseph pointed out, you know, housing, the shelter inflation was the biggest component of the last core CPI rise. And then last but not least, there is also what I believe to be a demographic supply inelasticity in the highest tenured parts of the labor supply. So all of these things combined together concern me, because as everybody's pointed out, we're not exactly the macro data have been somewhat confusing in that there's been something for everything, right? For everyone. Where, you know, if you are looking for a recession, well, sure, you can point to pockets of weakness. If you want to look at CRE, if you want to look at the more levered parts of the economy that are more beleaguered, that are more sensitive to floating rates. But the problem here is that the Fed has a blunt tool. It does not have a surgical knife in its policy. It's not as if it can do something to just alleviate the what I call the have-nots, both on the consumer and on the corporate side. Because in applying this blunt tool of federal funds policy, I think what it risks doing when it's doing it too early is that it is going to shift aggregate demand curves to the right. And when that's met by this whole confluence of supply inelasticities, I think, depending on how aggressive the Fed is, certainly if the Fed is as aggressive as the markets are predicting, I think we're going to have a second wave in this, probably by the second half of next year. And then the Fed is going to have a very, very hard decision.
Thank you, Michael. So, Jem, I'm actually going to kick it to you here. You've mentioned in the past the possibility of higher interest rates on the horizon, despite some evidence of inflation cooling. Can you touch on that a little bit here while we're still on the topic? What can or will drive inflation higher in the near future?
Yeah, no, I appreciate it. So, I can't think of better company than Michael Kell on these things. I completely agree with the commentary about inelastic. I'll put it semantically in some of my own terms. He said inelasticity. It really is inelastic to the upside, right? I think he said supply elasticity, and that essentially, I think, is what he's intimating. But particularly as it relates to real estate, I think this is a great example of you know, people think it's kind of linear up and down in terms of, you know, how much interest rates affect things. And in this market, that couldn't be further from the truth. As interest rates have gone higher, all that does is that creates sequestered demand, right? That sits there until interest rates come down, right? And this is a function of people being locked into that are currently in their homes into very low interest rates below the market, but the demand being kind of building until interest rates are more and housing is more affordable for the average person. But there is a massive amount of sequestered demand that is sitting there and has been sitting there waiting for interest rates to come down. So the Fed has an incredible asymmetric tool in terms of being able to cyclically affect the real estate, you know, the demand broadly, but the engine of real estate to stimulate demand by just lowering interest rates. And it's not just the short dated, the point here is getting that 10-year yield down, which they've been able to do to some extent here. This is why in December of last year, when they used their commentary to price out 6 cuts for this year, which didn't happen, right? Why they were able to all of a sudden kick off a massive rally at the beginning of the year. And of course, all the GDP numbers and everything came roaring back so quickly. The reality is that that's now at work. Any negative numbers that you were seeing 2 months ago, a month ago, guess what? They're now being already battled, regardless of what the Fed does at this point, by the demand that's been stimulated due to lower mortgage rates and lower financing costs. So that is essentially, in a microcosm, what it looks like, what that inelasticity looks like in real estate. And real estate is obviously a major driver of global economy, the U.S. economy in particular. So I think that's important to note, that they have the ability, and they've already lowered interest rates. Whatever they do today is almost kind of secondary, as long as they can keep in line with what they've been trying to communicate to markets. I do think they'll probably go 50 basis points, but it almost doesn't matter. What matters is what they've been able to do to expectations of longer term yields. Now, both Michael Cao and I agree on the fact that inflation is likely to be secular for all these structural reasons that we've talked about, that the trade has been, and you know, we thought this was the case, has been the case to bet on a steepener. I think that'll continue to be the trade. Short-term interest rates are coming down, but we believe long-term interest rates should not be. And actually, the more the Fed stimulates here, we believe that you will have a resurgence of structural inflation here, regardless of the cyclical effects and the ability to, over shorter periods of time, speed up the economy and slow it down based on these cyclical effects. So that's our broad view still. It has been from the very beginning. It's not about what's going to happen to short-term yields. It's about what's happening structurally underneath the hood with populism, protectionism, all of the demand push economy based on kind of fiscal spending and again, labor supply that ultimately will drive and will continue to surprise relative to the cyclical economic effects that are happening in the short term. And that ultimately is what you need to keep your eyes on. The second you get these opportunities where people are playing yesterday's game, which is just playing the cyclical, okay, is the economy slowing or speeding up in terms of how they're looking at 5-year, 10-year, 30-year yields, whenever those reactions happen, we believe those are big secular opportunities to really make bets on the back end of the curve and inflation. So that's where we have stood, and that's where we continue to stand. We think this is an incredible opportunity. Once again, much like it was, has been several times throughout the last 3 years, to get back into those trades.
Thank you, Jim. Does anybody have any other comments before I move along here?
If I could, I'll add one more thing to this, which is, you know, as I totally agree with Jen. I think we have to watch housing. In my piece, I wrote that, you know, the my biggest concern is shelter and housing because of this twin effect of the structural supply inelasticity plus this demographic demand inelasticity. And now they're talking, you know, where just the rhetoric alone has already juiced, you know, everything from mortgage applications to housing starts to multifamily starts. So that's one issue. But the much bigger issue, I think, that gets a little bit of short shrift is the credit markets and just how sanguine the credit markets are. Because when I, you know, when I look at the entire, what I call the leveraged credit trifecta, which is comprised of, you know, the roughly 1.6 trillion high yield market, the roughly 1.6 trillion leveraged loan market, and then now the extremely fast growing private credit market, which some estimate to be as high as 1.8 trillion, all three markets, especially private credit, are just on fire. There, every other day, I'm in this private group where we vet investment deals. It seems like every other day there's a new private credit fund being raised. And so I think if you want to think about credit as the ultimate sort of multiplicative lubricant for the economy, there's just no problem there right now. I mean, again, you can point to pockets of weakness, but that's why I think there's this, you know, macro confusion that potentially is going to lead policymakers down the wrong path. I think policymakers in general are too hell-bent on fighting the last war, which was the real last war was the GFC. And everybody is still worried about the GFC when I think when you look at the much longer arc of history here, the analog that we should be worried about is something much closer to the stagflationary 70s. At least that's what I'm concerned about.
Thank you, Michael. And there's quite a few things in that last bit that I'm going to circle back to later, namely on the topics of credit and on housing. But for now, Joseph, I want to kind of pivot back here to that discussion of how much and how fast rates will be cut. Joseph, you mentioned on Making Money with Charles Payne recently that the 50 bips cut actually does support that notion of a soft landing. And you also mentioned that on the flip side of that is a potential negative effect on the U.S. dollar. Can you speak to that a bit, Joseph? What would be the connotations on the U.S. dollar should they go ahead and throw out that 50 bits cut right off the bat this month?
So when I think about the dollar, well, in general, one of the things that stands out about the U.S. is that we have a tremendous fiscal deficit. If you look at the IMF projections, it's about 6% a year forever. Now, in comparison to peer countries, so other wealthy countries, their expected deficit over the next few countries, in the next few years, is about 2%. Now, usually when a country has a large fiscal deficit, you would expect their currency to depreciate. And with a 6% fiscal deficit, that obviously puts downward pressure on the dollar. You can think of it as government is printing a lot of dollars, which is what treasuries are. But one thing that's been holding the dollar up is our high interest rates compared to many other countries across the world. Now, as we go through this rate cutting cycle, if it's very aggressive and the market is pricing in a very aggressive cutting cycle, I'm not sure if that's going to be correct. The market, to remind everyone, is very bad at guessing the Fed. But if that is realized, you can see a country with a large fiscal deficit and low rates, you know, that's a recipe for a weak currency. And I think that has very big impacts on both the financial markets and the economy. From the financial markets perspective, there are a lot of foreigners who hold U.S. equities. U.S. equities have performed very well over the past few years, and we are home to a lot of the leading tech companies like AI stuff. So, you know, if you're a foreign investor, and the dollar weakens a lot, you're going to lose a lot on the currency side. And maybe you want to sell your stocks to get out, you know, something like a little bit of what happened with the blow up of the yen carry trade a couple of months back. So, you know, that could be actually quite negative for risk assets if foreigners decide to sell because they don't want to have FX losses. Now, the other side of having a weak currency is that usually when you have a weak currency, your imports become more expensive, and you can think of it as commodity prices going higher, and that would be inflationary. So I think maybe these rate cuts, given our current configuration of the financial system, will not be as positive as they're perceived to be.
So I actually do kind of want to touch on that just a little bit. Michael, you also touched on this recently when discussing the topic of aggressive rate cuts as a whole, those effects on the US dollar. And you mentioned that if, quote, we have this aggressive competitive rate cutting cycle, how can that not be reflationary? So, Michael, can you expand upon that and maybe even touch on your commentary to keep it on that topic of foreign countries and the effects therein, when you said outdove the U.S. Fed is what they need to do?
Yeah, thank you. So you're probably referring to a piece I wrote maybe a month or two ago. I talked about how, you know, the strong dollar, I've been labeling the U.S. dollar wrecking ball, and, you know, just being kind of cute, I said, okay, is it going to get downgraded to the U.S. dollar pickleball? And I said, okay, there are three paths to the U.S. dollar pickleball here. The first one, and I've heard some theories about this, is that, okay, there's going to be a Plaza Accord 2, and that's an overt devaluation of the dollar. I see that as a very low likelihood because, remember, when Plaza Accord 1 happened in 1985, the DXY was 165, and it was basically essentially the top five economies getting together, trying to correct trade imbalances. The dollar was way too strong, and it behooved everybody to want a weaker dollar. Here, we've got DXY at right around 101 here, and frankly, you know, to your point, one of the dynamics right now is that the U.S. economy is generally stronger than most of our big peer economies. So especially when you compare the U.S. economy to the more export sensitive economies of Europe, Japan, and China, it does not behoove our big trade partners to see a weaker dollar. So that leads me to path two to the U.S. dollar pickleball, which is that if the Fed is aggressive in lowering rates and therefore weakening the dollar, might that spur a competitive cutting cycle amongst our partners, where they don't want to see their export competitiveness dented? So I think there's still very much a desire on the part of the other central banks to outdove the Fed. So in both of these cases, both scenarios one and two, I think present very reflationary outcomes for the U.S. There is a path three, a golden path that I laid out in that path, where I could see a structurally weaker dollar, and that has to do with somehow at least solving the artificial supply inelasticity in oil. And I outlined this because I said, look, a lot of this is geopolitical and depends on potentially who wins the election. I think if Trump wins, there is a much higher likelihood that he's going to broker some kind of deal with Saudi Arabia, like an oil for security guarantee type of deal, whereby he gets Saudi Arabia to end their unilateral cuts, brings back an additional 3 million barrels of oil to the market. That would have the effect of taking oil down to the 50s. But interestingly, right, why would Saudi Arabia do that? Well, number one, Saudi Arabia has been wanting a security guarantee for decades, or if not centuries, you could say, right, because of the Sunni-Shia rivalry. But number two, Saudi Arabia is the only producer in the world that has enough spare capacity to make up for lower prices with increased volume. So again, oil is just one of what, like 7 or 8 different supply inelasticities I talked about, but it's a very, very important one. And so I say that this path three is, it could be a golden path, but lower oil prices are just a necessary but insufficient condition to winning the inflation fight. So those are my three scenarios for the dollar.
Thank you, Michael. Last bear, do you have any comments on what we've said so far before I move on to the next question?
Yeah, I was actually surprised that Sam didn't bring up fiscal earlier in one of his, I think he did mention it, but that it wasn't the first time on his lips, because I know that that's a point that he's been hammering for some time. And I think it's really a smart point. But I think we do need to, you know, we're talking about the supply side of things like oil and whatever. Obviously, oil now is probably the lowest point that it's been in some time. But, you know, when we think about the causes of inflation, I think we also need to look back to the circumstances that created 9% inflation, which obviously some amount of that was supply disruption, particularly, you know, getting energy production, oil production back to where it was before the pandemic. But also, obviously, the huge amount of fiscal stimulus that sort of helped turbocharge demand. And if you remember when inflation was at 9%, you had companies talking about how easy it was to pass on prices. That's a very different situation that we have now. And so I think a big question that we don't really have an answer to right now is, what's going to happen on the fiscal side? Who's going to win in November? Who's going to win the House and the Senate? What policies are actually going to be put in place? If there is some sort of, you know, dip in payrolls or whatever, will that be countered by significant more direct stimulus? I think that's a huge aspect of this. I think all sort of signs on both sides of the aisle is for, you know, more spending, less taxes. In other words, increasing sort of the fiscal deficits, which I would say is sort of long-term inflationary. But I think that's a big, a big component that we need to keep in mind.
Thank you, Last Bear. So just kind of on the topic on how the Fed functions in terms of their policy, in terms of how we're going to move forward with managing those interest rates, Joseph, on making money again here, to the question of who does the Fed work for, you mentioned, when I look at their actions and interpretation of their mandate, I have to walk away with the sense that they're working for Wall Street, citing specifically their mandate on inflation. So, Joseph, can you walk us through that a bit here? Does that mean the Fed is going to essentially taper down these rates in a way that most benefits the equities market? Or can you kind of give us some light there?
So one of the things that I've noticed over the past few years is some profound, I guess, unfairness in how the inflation mandate is managed. Now, of course, the Fed aspires for prices, inflation about 2%, but then that's only certain prices. When it comes to things like asset prices, equities, or homes, those prices can go up to the moon and they don't even care at all. But when it comes to things that impact more, more of the average person, let's say your wage growth, how much money can you make each year? Well, if wage inflation is a little bit high, let's say not even super high, 3 or 4%, then the Fed jumps into action and does everything it can to slow that down. And so I think that's kind of a recipe for tremendous amounts of inequality in the world, which is kind of what we've seen over the past two decades, right? Explosion in wealth inequality. And I think a key driver of that is just how that mandate is interpreted. And this is largely the Fed's doing. And so it leaves me with the impression that, you know, the Fed kind of favors Wall Street over Main Street. Now, I want to be clear, I think they have good intentions. And I think it's important to get inflation stable, as that benefits everyone. But this type of interpretation in its mandate really does give the impression that if you are a working person, a blue-collar person, it seems like the economy is, the rules are not tilted in your favor. So now also I will note that the way that the Fed interprets their mandates or even sets their mandates is ultimately a political decision. The Fed did not have their 2% inflation mandate until 2012. And it's a consensus that took over a decade to build, where everyone has different views on this. So there's nothing set in stone about this, and it could potentially change. If you recall, a couple years ago, when we were having higher than expected inflation, there were a whole bunch of people jumping out and saying, you know, maybe we can have 3 or 4% inflation and that's okay. And maybe that will change in the future as well. But right now, I think that the outcome suggests that the Fed is not super in favor of Main Street when it comes to conducting policy.
Thank you, Joseph. Jim, I see your hand.
Yeah, I actually want to zoom out for a second. And actually, I think Joseph brings up an excellent point. But I want to make sure it doesn't sound as political as I think he's making it out to be. And this is almost philosophical. The reality is the Fed has been given a mandate by government to control inflation while maximizing employment. And I think that the problem roots there. At the end of the day, what people don't realize, and that policymakers who mandated the Fed to do this didn't really contemplate or understand, is that at the end of the day, the cheat code for maintaining, within those boundaries for maximizing and optimizing for low inflation, yet higher employment and higher GDP growth, is to take the velocity of money to zero and send that money to those who do not spend, who do not create goods inflation. That, to Joseph's point, create asset inflation. If you send money to the rich, it creates growth without inflation. That is solving for the equation that they've been given. That's where the root of this problem really lies. The problem is there's a cost that is then skirted away and acted like it's not their responsibility, because it's not, because government has told them it's not their mandate, and which is inequality. There is a cost to achieving this optimization to these two functions, and that is to hurt inequality. And that creates political lack of cohesion. It creates all kinds of other issues. We're not maximizing the median outcomes. We're maximizing to mean outcomes. That is free markets, natural selection at its core. But if we believe in fairness or in justice or whatever these concepts are that America is underpinned by, which are not natural, by the way, right? Life is not fair. But if those are not our priorities or those are not important to us, then okay, that's what the Fed is supposed to do, and that's what they will do. The problem is people are in the system. We are not cogs. We are not maximizing GDP relative to inflation. We're maximizing people's happiness and people's contentment. And that's, we call that politics. But is that politics, or is that just, what are we optimizing to the wrong thing? And so at the core foundation of what the Federal Reserve is doing and asked to do basically necessitates this type of reaction function. And that leaves Powell saying, not our responsibility, government, go do something. But if government is sclerotic and does not know how to make those changes, we end up in a flywheel that just repeats the same issues over and over until things break. And that's where we are.
Thank you, Jim. And I'm going to be honest, folks, kind of unrelated, but related. Once someone's done talking, if you have something to add, go ahead and chime in. It looks like the hand raise emoji is still just broken. So we'll just keep it as fluid as possible. If we get some overlap, that's not the end of the world. So if you ever have points to add, just go ahead and jump in. If I'm already asking a question, I'll shut up and let you go. Celeste Bear and Michael, are those two hands real, or am I getting juked out by Twitter?
No, it is real. This is such a great discussion, because what both Joseph and Jim said reminded me to bring this topic up of how inflation, it's a reminder to everybody that inflation is the most regressive tax there is that impacts 100% of people. And so when you think about the poorest decile of society, right, that's living hand to mouth, paycheck to paycheck, their paychecks are being completely eaten up by the costs of food, fuel and shelter, right? So when I talk about macro confusion and macro confusion potentially leading to very poor policy choices, I bring up this example a couple of weeks ago where somebody was highlighting this spike in credit card delinquencies as a sign that the Fed needs to come to the rescue of the beleaguered, you know, cash-strapped consumer. And I said, hold on a second. This is all wrong, because when you think about who actually pays interest on credit card balances, it is the poorest part of society. It doesn't matter that interest, credit card interest rates are 22% now, and during ZIRP, maybe they're, you know, in the mid to high teens. This is the segment of society where they are in debt because of inflation, not because of high credit card interest rates. And so if you look at that as a perfect sign of how, you know, just first order thinking can lead to very, very poor policy choices, look no further. And I'll just point out that, you know, when you look at unemployment, right, people are freaking out over the latest labor revisions, saying that, okay, well, you know, now we're at 4.3%, whatever. The point here is that even if unemployment were to go to 5%, let's say, it is still relatively low relative to the much longer arc of history. And it's a reminder that even at 5% unemployment, it still means that 95% of society is employed, whereas the most regressive tax of all, inflation, impacts 100% of people. And most disproportionately hurts the lowest deciles of society.
And you know, that's the thing. There is fiscal policy does not actually, you get a one-to-one trade-off essentially for inflation, despite the populism that drives that fiscal push. If done without kind of a multiple effect or an investment in long term, whether it's education or healthcare or other things, if it's just dollar payments to people, the net effect is inflation, which then again, one to one hurts those same people. So this is why once it gets going, populism just gets people more and more frustrated, which leads to more fiscal, which leads to more populism. It's a circle, and the problem is inequality. And that inequality has really been driven by pushing money to the top, and it's hard to solve without pulling money from the top and redistributing.
So this is absolutely beautiful. This is why I love these panels so much, guys. The back and forth, the tag-ons, everything is just perfection. It makes my life as a proctor extremely easy. And so I kind of want to kick this idea a little bit more and put it into the scope of the economy. Last Bear, you've actually written in the past about the economy remaining on, quote, solid footing, despite a lot of the fear seen in the media and in market news. And you touched on it once again at the end of August in your newsletter article titled Slippery Slope. One line that kind of stood out to me in the first half of that article is when you said we shouldn't let what we think may happen in the future cloud what clearly is happening in the present. Now, to that end, what are you seeing currently for the economy as a whole? And are a lot of those bubble, recession, inflation fears unwarranted as we move closer into 2025? Or as the article title suggests, is the economy kind of towing that line and at risk of slippage? Because data is kind of showing decent feedback on how the economy is going this year, especially given the inflationary pressure and fears. But is that slope we're teetering on that slippery, Last Bear?
Yeah, so I think what that the line that you use, I think I was talking about, basically at the beginning of the year, I used the term solid footing, and I had made pretty positive or had a pretty positive view on the U.S. economy for much of the year. But I think that what I was saying in that article, which the title sort of suggests, is that the recent data, I think there's a fine line between sort of ignorance and, you know, optimism on certain things. And if you look at particularly the labor market. You know, you do see just consistent slowdown that is not, you know, that's not 1 month of data, that's 2 years of data across really all sort of labor market metrics, to the point where there's really no question as to obviously the you know, payrolls are still growing, but the rate of change of payrolls has been slowing for nearly 2 years. And those numbers keep getting lower and lower. You see the unemployment rate, which is taken from the household survey, obviously ticking up to 2.3, 2.2. I mean, it's been on a border of those two metrics for the past 2 months. It really didn't change that much in the most, you know, most recent report. But all those things, you have to kind of look at some sort of macro cyclical perspective and say, hey, there doesn't seem to be a whole lot of reacceleration if you're looking at sort of the most fundamental basis of the economy, which is employment, the ability to get jobs. And if you look at sort of more forward-looking views of that, like, you know, people talk about the Challenger job cuts report. But that report also, it obviously talks about job cuts. It also talks about hiring plans. And what they are showing in the hiring plans, which is arguably more forward-looking than job cuts, is that hiring plans are as low as they have been in almost 10 years, significantly below where they were, you know, before the pandemic. That's sort of reiterated by other things like the JOLTS surveys and other things. So basically, my point is that there's no real sign, and particularly in the labor market, of a reacceleration, and you just see a trend that's going, you know, that seems very sort of late cycle if you were to look back at prior sort of cycles. Now, there's been a lot of strange things that have happened in the past 4 years that make looking back at recent cycles maybe not the best way to look at the economy, and I think that that's why we need to be like really data dependent on it. But what I meant in my article was that we shouldn't at this point just assume that because the you know, because growth has continued sort of ahead of expectations for some time, that that's going to continue when we're looking at deterioration within the labor market, that, you know, that doesn't seem to be turning around. So I think that was sort of the crux of my point there.
Thank you for the clarifications, Les Bear. Does anybody have any comments to that end on the economy?
Well, I think one thing that really struck me was, I agree with Les Bear that Challenger report, I think their hiring intentions were the lowest that they've ever surveyed in the history of the survey. So it does seem like things are slowing down. Now, one of the things that I'm wondering is this some kind of a soft patch ahead of the election? Because, you know, we have two candidates with very different visions of the U.S. And so, you know, depending on who wins, you could have very different subsidies, very different tax regimes, and just a whole different policy outlook. So one of the things that I'm wondering is if this slow patch, which is real, and as Les Bear clearly noted, is it something that could resolve itself after the election when we have more certainty, or is it just an ongoing deterioration? So that's what I'm wondering when I see that data.
I guess I would just chime in here and kind of go back to something I said earlier, which is, you know, if the Fed is too late to prevent a recession, I guess the question I pose is that so bad? Because when inflation rates are obviously second derivatives of price, when an absolute price is very, very high, and that's what's actually killing the you know, poorest deciles of society, right? And so the issue that I have philosophically is that this eradication of business cycles has really resulted in big distortions in capital allocation over time. If you look at just microcosmically what's happening in the credit markets, there's something called distressed exchanges, which is basically, you know, some people will count that as a default, but there's really no impairment of par when basically a bond that would have otherwise defaulted if the credit spigots were dry, but because the credit spigots are not dry at all, These zombie companies are basically are allowed to exist. And, you know, especially with the proliferation of private credit, that's even refinancing some of the diciest CCC leverage loans out there. This extend and pretend phenomenon is really resulting in long-term capital misallocation for the economy. And so I pose the question to the panel and ultimately to policymakers, right? What is wrong with a garden variety recession?
Michael, don't you know there's an election coming up? We can't have a recession.
I do actually, speaking of the election, I want to jump in real quick and talk about the election because, again, I know we're focused on kind of today's policy, what is the Fed going to do? But I do want to look forward. I think it's an important time to do that. A couple of people have mentioned the election. And think about, you know, regardless of whether we think Trump is going to win or Harris is going to win, you know, what are the different outcomes likely mean? And what might that mean for inflation and markets broadly? I think that's an interesting topic that would be nice to kind of think about, and particularly as it relates to inflation and Federal Reserve policy. I think when we look at the primary drivers that both Michael and I and others on here have highlighted, you know, similar to what we saw in the late 60s, throughout the 70s, you know, we've seen a populist push, which I've covered, obviously. Fiscal policy at the core, Great Society program then, now, you know, more recently, the COVID responses and everything that's come since. Protectionism, which comes with populism, which leads to labor shortages and all kinds of other supply shortages. Again, globalization is deflationary. Deglobalization is inflationary. And then, the global conflict that comes from that protectionism. We've entered much like we did at that time, a much more not cooperative, you know, this is not about cooperation anymore. It's about competition. And so we've gone into a much more competitive global landscape where everybody is trying to leverage whatever strengths they may have. And that does lead to global conflict, both cold and hot. And lastly, it also leads to commodity scarcity and supply constraints and all kinds of protectionism of commodities. And when I say commodities, you know, think about what's happening with rare earths. Think about what's happening with chips and processors. Think about what's happening with energy. And all of these things are again happening. Again, if you can't see them, your head's in the ground right now. The question is, how do those drivers, those primary drivers, potentially get changed by either a Trump versus a Harris administration? I would argue that fiscal likely won't be all that different under the two policies, the two administrations, that it's driven by this populist demand by the people. You may be able to argue, much like Trump did in his first presidency, that he's more likely to say one thing and then go cut taxes for the rich. So there is some of that I think we need to be cognizant of, which could be less inflationary and more inflationary for assets. I think we should be aware of that. I think some of the pricing in here early in the rally may have had something to do with that, but that's something that we need to be mindful of and think about. But I think from a fiscal spending perspective, at least, I think that they'll be very similar. I think from a global conflict perspective, I think we really need to be mindful of China and other entities outside of the US and the developed world looking to see who is going to be elected before they move. So regardless, I think there's a bit of a holding pattern happening, which I think we need to be mindful regardless of who becomes president. There will be a moving forward in one kind of path or another towards this consistent direction of global conflict. Again, we've only seen an acceleration since we've been on these doing these spaces, despite what has become a bit of a normalization in people's minds of the Russia-Ukraine war and now the Middle East, essentially Iran-Israel conflict is what I would call it, despite that not being what it's called in the media. I think there's a third front likely on the way, regardless in Asia. The question is, I think under a Trump administration, it probably happens sooner and ends somewhat sooner without as much of a a broader decade-long multi-year conflict. And we may, despite it being sooner, more potentially more severe in the short term, we are probably more likely to move past it sooner, given that he is less likely in an America First kind of scenario to intervene directly. I think from an oil perspective, there's very little. I'm not as confident that we can that Trump will make a deal with Saudi, but he might. I think that's a reasonable point by Cal. I do think inroads in Venezuela are likely to happen under either administration, but particularly during a Harris administration, to try and find a solution there. Whether that will be possible or not is another question. I think the biggest difference, though, is in immigration. I think the cheat code that the Biden administration has deployed somewhat unpopularly is to allow immigration to be much more open in the United States. And regardless of how you feel about the politics of that, the reality is, in a competitive landscape, one of the few assets that the U.S. One of the many assets that the U.S. has, but one of the best, is its ability to attract people from around the world and relieve some of the structural labor shortage issues that we have via immigration. You can argue about what kind of immigration we're doing, and whether it's the right immigration, yada yada. But we have, I think, under a Harris administration, there is a dramatic open immigration policy that continues, which is helping to subdue some of the effects of labor shortages and the inflationary pressures. I would argue that will be the exact opposite policy, especially early on from Trump, in a much more anti-immigration policy, which will likely help stoke inflation and have some of the counter effects otherwise. So I just want to highlight these different issues, particularly as they relate to structural inflation, and really have us think about, you know, how these different paths might change inflationary outcomes, and whether or not we think one is more inflationary than the other.
I think that's a really good point, and I totally agree with Jem that focusing on politics is probably going to have a bigger impact on the economy. And between the Trump and Harris administration, the biggest difference is likely going to be immigration. President Trump makes it one of his signature policies to have less immigration. But one thing I would note, and going back to Michael's point a bit earlier, that one of the most persistent elements in inflation is shelter, is that I think so far having massive immigration, maybe some downward pressure on certain segments of the labor market, but it's unambiguously having upward pressure on things like housing and social services, which, as mentioned earlier, are less elastic when it comes to supply. Now, recently I was looking at a speech from the Reserve Bank of Australia, and they actually have not actually cut rates, contrary to many other countries, in part because inflation is still high, around 4%, and inflation is high to a large extent because rental inflation is going to the moon. And why is rental inflation going to the moon? Because they have massive immigration, let's say 2 to 3% of their total population in a year. If you look at Canada, they do something similar, 2 to 3% increase in their population through immigration, and rents go through to the moon. And in the U.S., again, bigger country, different cities have different policies. But when you look at, say, New York City, which has a policy of being open to migrants, vacancies are at all-time lows. So, you know, there are some, the immigration policy has uneven impacts on inflation. And so if we actually have less migration, maybe we will have higher wages, for sure, things like construction, blue collars. But I think also we would have less demand on services like real estate. And so there's a balancing act there to that I think the public will have to decide.
We've got about 3 minutes until we get some data here. Does anyone have any other comments to what Joseph and Jem said while we await this data? So what I want to do then here, and we'll probably have to double back after we get the data drop so we can have some time to look through the release and give folks some time to look at dot plots. But I want to touch on that topic of gold and commodities as a broader scope as well. But we'll start with gold. In the last few months, obviously, we've all seen gold set new highs after new highs. Some speculate is due in part to the hotter than expected CPI, possibly making gold an inflation hedge play. Joseph, you, however, noted that in the past, even with abysmal CPI prints, gold itself wasn't doing very well either. So my question to that end is, what's the most likely factor behind this gilded rocket ship that seemingly has no signs of slowing?
That's a great, great question. You know, when I look at gold, I notice that people approach it from all different angles. Some people look at it as an inflation hedge. And as you know, Nicholas, it doesn't seem to have worked very well for the past few years. Remember when CPI was up 8% year over year, gold was not doing well. I think there's a number of drivers to this gold rally, and I'm looking forward to hearing what other people think about this. Of course, we have the central bank buying, a lot of news articles saying how especially EM central banks have been increasing their gold holdings. China hasn't been buying the past few months, but they've been buying a lot the past year. Now, in addition to that, we are embarking upon a global easing cycle. And usually people associate looser monetary policy with gold up in price. And we have a global easing cycle, and we're probably going to cut a lot. The market thinks the Fed is going to cut a lot. ECB has already cut twice. Bank of Canada cut three times. And the market expects all these guys to continue to cut. So one other thing, of course, is there's a lot of geopolitical conflict that's, I think, becoming worse. If you look at what's happening in Ukraine or what's happening in the Middle East, this past week, we got pagers blowing up in some parts of the Middle East. We have potentially the authorization by the West to allow Ukraine to use missiles deep into Russia. That's a geopolitical conflict that's rising. And what I've noticed over the past few months is that whenever there's heightened geopolitical conflict, gold gets a bid. So I think there's a lot of things that are working in gold's favor right now. So it's no surprise to me that it's doing well.
Yeah, I would echo Joseph's comments. I do think the central bank buying has been a huge part of it. You can see that effect actually in the difference in price of gold miners versus the physical. So that is actually a record, relative to one another. Gold miners, which are, you know, more equity, have dramatically lagged the price of gold. And I think that's because of the actual underlying supply and demand forces that are acting on physical gold. By the way, that is an opportunity if you believe gold will continue to stay at these levels or go higher. But gold itself, to Joseph's point, in my opinion, is tied into this primary point, which is after the election, right? There are a lot of forces that have been more or less in a holding pattern for a year, and particularly as it relates to global conflict. And we believe that a lot of those inflationary pressures, I think what gold's telling you is don't keep whistling by the graveyard on these inflationary pressures, that there are these pressures, again, global conflict, labor protectionism, commodity pricing, fiscal policy will likely reaccelerate, and we'll get back to kind of the trends which we continue to see, but they will reaccelerate likely into next year, and that's what I think it's basically telling you, and I think that's what central bank buying, by the way, is telling you as well.
All right, I'll interrupt really quickly. Fed cut by 50 basis points, just as Jim predicted. So let's take a look at the dot plot to see if anything else changed. It looks like markets are liking this.
Watching SPY right now, they are really liking it, Joseph. Directly off the data release, we shot from 562 to 569 almost. And I'm curious to see how this reaction continues. What is everybody seeing at a cursory glance here?
Yeah, so there's a huge cut in the dot plot for the end of the year 2024. So I think that's probably the big incremental surprise here is on the dot plot. Going down to 4.4 for the end of the year from 5.1 as of the June projection. So in 3 months, you got 60 bips of incremental easing expectations.
Yeah, expectations. I think the prior estimates were 75, possibly as high as 100, and now it seems 150 bips cut total.
And it's interesting because obviously people ask whether, you know, big cuts are good or bad for the market, depending on whether the market thinks that the Fed is scared of recession. Obviously, in this case, at least the first reaction seems to be that the market is very happy about the prospect of lower rates and at this point is not concerned from the macro implications of that.
I think Jim has mentioned a lot that sometimes these moves a lot have to do with people taking off risk off this risk event. I don't know what the options positioning is like, Jim. Maybe you can speak to that.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Joseph. Yeah, the vol for this event and the skew for this event have been dramatic for some time. I think that's a fair word relative to everything around it, partially not just driven by the fact that it's a Fed meeting, but as often happens during these Fed meetings, it falls on a big set quarterly expiration. The AM expiration for this Friday has been pricing in skew that's dramatically different than everything around it and has been for some time. So what happens as those puts decay, if the downside risk of, they haven't been as in line with expectations, and the second, even if this was just an inline statement, you would expect the decay of those puts to dramatically happen, which is what you're beginning to see. And then the obvious buyback of all the deltas that dealers have against those. So that this initial, reflexive rally here is not a surprise. This is what you would expect. Now, to be clear, it's a bit more aggressive than the full expectation, which is also broadly stimulative. But bulls have the wind at their back broadly in this scenario. Basically a negative in the absence of a negative surprise, market go up, and you can see that broadly in historical data. If you look at Fed, this is a pretty crazy stat, but for the last 40 years, if you look at Fed. Fed days, and you took them all out, you have essentially almost 0% returns for the market. These are generally very positive, and it's because of that effect. The Fed generally does not want to negatively surprise the market. They overwhelmingly don't. And in the absence of a negative surprise, markets price in a rally. Again, not a every time thing, but it is a high probability, high impact bet.
All right, everybody. Thank you, Jim. I just want to jump in here. I mentioned at the beginning we would be joined by the GOAT himself, Danny Ives. And Dan, I know you just got here. Thank you for joining us, but I'm going to put you on the spot right away. So, go ahead.
Nah, I mean, this as a bull and a tech bull, this is as Goldilocks as you get in terms of what you want to see. I mean, we'll see with the press conference. Obviously, it's going to be super dovish, but from a tech perspective, I mean, this is about as risk on as you could have in terms of what you want to hear from the Fed.
And I wanted to ask you about exactly that, Dan. We've been discussing the connotations of 25, 50, even 70 basis points all week, it seems. And given this advent of the 50 bips right out of the gate today, how are you expecting to see tech stocks react?
Well, I think it's really, and your speaker's done such a great job in terms of the initial reaction, but this, and I could tell even from investors that I'm getting in the last few minutes, I mean, this is going to be a major risk on trade for big tech because it's the derivatives, because now the view is even from a CapEx perspective, what this is going to do, even when we look out in terms of that dot plot next 6, 9, 12 months, this is bullish in terms of CapEx taking on debt, really stimulation of the system, which is very important, especially when you think about this AI revolution, because that would be the one thing that could, we'll call, say, spoiled the party from an AI perspective, is just Fed getting late, recession happening, and ultimately starting to see more of a curtail of CapEx. What this essentially does, it takes, in my opinion, that like little sort of tail event off the table, which is bullish for tech.
I would also add, I mean, obviously the whole market's up, but I think the market leader on the news is small caps. And obviously small caps are the most levered companies. Obviously everyone benefits to some extent, but the people who are the most beleaguered, REITs are doing well. Small caps are getting quite the bid on this.
I couldn't agree more on that comment on the small cap side. Yeah.
I just follow up since we're talking about gold. It looks like spot gold made a new all-time high.
I think everybody's shocked. Gold's just been chugging. And I do want to curve back to equities, but first I want to stay on this topic of tech, especially now with the 50 bips. Everybody's been kind of clambering on about, oh, tech's in a bubble, AI's in a bubble. And Dan, you seem to very obviously hold the opposing opinion that the upside potential for such companies such as Apple, such as NVIDIA, especially in the case of AI, a second wave is actually just around the corner. So does today just straight up confirm that for you, Dan?
We just got back from Asia, second trip there last 6 weeks. Demand's outstripping supply 15 to 1. So when you look at the demand in terms of these use cases blowing out, I mean, this is just now going to give further fuel because the CapEx is there in terms of big tech. I mean, you have basically $250 billion line of sight to what I believe is going to be $1 trillion of incremental CapEx next 3 years when it comes to AI. And when you look at the consumer piece, it's a matter of when, not if, from an Apple iPhone 16 AI-driven super cycle. I think you've seen the stock recover a lot from some of those yelling fire in a crowd theater reports on the pre-orders, you know, that obviously hit the stock this week. But it all comes down to just demand. I believe it's a fourth industrial revolution. The only thing that was going to spoil the party was Fed being late to the game and the self-fulfilling prophecy and the bears owning the narrative. That's done. And I believe tech rallies hard into year end.
Dan, I want to hop in and ask you a question and take a kind of be polemical here and take the other side of this. Sure. What do you think would happen to NVIDIA and broadly kind of the semiconductor space if China was to move on Taiwan?
That's always been the black swan event, right?
And I think it's not a black swan. What do you think the odds are? What do you think the odds are, Dan?
I think there's a better chance right now me playing in the NBA than that happened. That's been my view. And for the last 20 years, I've talked to tech investors about China, Taiwan, and they've missed every transformational tech trade because they feared it. So as someone that goes to Taiwan 4 times a year, it's a risk. I get it, but I still view it as a very, very infinitesimal percentage here. Okay. That's my
So less than 1% that China moves on Taiwan in the next 4 years.
Yes, definitely. That's my view.
Okay. All right. I would say it's actually, and this is what China has told you, and is what based on my contacts within the U.S. administration and Palantir, it's closer to 50%, if not 60. And just to give you a sense of what people who are on the ground think is probable. Now, they may be wrong and you may be right, but just so you know, that's what the current people, the broad belief is. The next 4 years, I'm not saying in the next 6 months.
And what's interesting there is like, I mean, we go to Taiwan and we're in Asia all the time. And I get the nervousness. And I'm not saying that there's not some validity at one point. I'm just like, and this just goes down to stocks, right? In other words, in 25 years of covering tech, so many times, whether it was Greek debt crisis, Europe, geopolitical, macro, Middle East, whatever, so many investors have missed basically every transformational big tech name because they got caught up in the like what if moment. I'm not saying it doesn't happen. I'm just saying that's been my view is like I focus on fundamentally what's going to happen and where we are, especially in tech. And I think right now, like it is a risk on trade. That is just, I mean, to me that, and this was kind of like the last piece of the puzzle that needed to happen.
Fair. Well, we'll have to kind of see how that plays out. It's not just the China percent, by the way. And the math is simple. I'm not saying that it's going to happen or it's not going to happen. But if there is a high probability of something happening there in the next 4 years, let's say 50%, and the production declines at NVIDIA would be 85% under that scenario. You likely see a decline of 50 to 75% in those names, just to kind of put it in context.
Of course, and that's what makes the market, right? The bulls I get that bear argument, and that's a conversation I've had with investors, for decades.
But the world, the world doesn't price in the tail, right? The world would rather sell the tail and then deal with it when it happens. And
is everybody able to hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. Can everybody else?
Yes. Yep.
So anyway, to finish that thought, I also would argue there's it's priced for perfection, right? Yes, currently the trends are much like they were with tech in 98 and 99 and 2000. Anyway, to finish the thought, there are other constraints, energy being a primary issue here, right? In the AI push, along with a number of other legal and regulatory issues, which I think everybody is just kind of ignoring altogether. It is easy to just say risk on, look at demand now. Nobody's debating the current demand structures, but much like in the tech bubble hype days, everything, the stories, it was so obvious that why would you not buy the internet? Well, ultimately 95% of all internet companies went bankrupt and the NASDAQ lost 91% of its value. So I've seen this hype cycle before. Everything seems so obvious when you're in it. That it can only go up. There's only one number. Look at the demand. It's so obvious. But it's always the things you're not looking at that get you.
Yeah. And I would just add, I get great points. But I mean, big tech has $1.2 trillion on the balance sheet today. And these are companies that are going to generate another $400 or $500 billion per year. So that's really where the AI revolutions come from versus in the late 90s. Startups, there's a lot of sort of hype. So I'm just saying, when I compare and contrast in terms of what I believe is this fourth industrial revolution playing out.
I actually do want to touch a little bit on that topic of growth, but I want to take it to the topic of the jobs market in terms of tech. Now, from a BLS data set turned into a chart by Joseph Politano, another friend of the show, it's shown that our current jobs market for tech is kind of abysmally low compared to just a year or two ago. And it's more akin to the lower job market for tech that we saw in the 2010s, though it's nowhere near as bad as like right after 2001, right after 2008. It's still fairly low. So I'll start with Dan on this one, and then I love kicking it around the panel again. Do you foresee that jobs market picking up again in tech as we kind of move forward, or are things becoming more automated? How do you view the jobs landscape in tech right now?
Oh, no, I think we've been through like a period of like companies were spending, overspending. We've seen the efficiency phase here. But I believe just given this arms race, it will start to pick back up. I mean, it was like, I actually think job growth will actually start to increase from here after this period of efficiency, especially what we've seen coming out of the valley and just given this, which is essentially it's an arms race going on right now in big tech.
Yeah, I think on the tech space, it's just the case that these companies can make so much money. I kind of ironically think that, they sort of sandbagged themselves by taking on employees that, are highly paid and in some cases don't necessarily work a whole lot. In some cases to give them a lever to release and when they need to. And we went through a big one of those cycles. And so I don't know that you can really look at employment broadly in the tech space as being indicative of sort of the underlying trends of the technology and advancement necessarily.
So I want to go back here, and this one, again, definitely can kick this one around the panel. We've got a good 12, 13 minutes left before Powell's presser. I want to touch on kind of how people are viewing the markets as a whole as we move forward. Michael, you wrote last week, to quote you from your tweet, "I find myself oddly unhedged non-committal on macro right now and completely focused on idiosyncratic and event-driven stuff, as well as having degrossed your market cap arb due to valuation concerns rather than credit concerns. Michael, where do your concerns lie in terms of valuations?
I was in that tweet, I was referring specifically to my for those who don't know what my macro cap arb is that over the last year or so, I've owned CLO equity closed end funds yielding almost like 20%, and using that positive carry to fund various macro hedges against the rest of my book. So I bought, I was very opportunistic in buying those closed end funds at 7% discounts to NAV, and now they're trading at 15% premiums to NAV. So that's what I was referring to. But it does underscore this underlying thirst for yield that, you know, these vehicles are trading at such hefty valuations. And remember that the underlying, what the NAVs represent are their underlying CLO equities, and those underlying CLO equities have gone up as well, right? So that's what I was referring to. And with respect to my comment about hiding in sort of idiosyncratic alpha names, it's exactly that, you know, I'm not bullish on equity beta given valuations and this potential for an anti-Goldilocks scenario. And by anti-Goldilocks, I define as growth that's just slow enough to allow some of these high flyer stocks to start missing earnings. And also because of their potential their inability to pass through cost increases, but growth that's just weak enough to cause problems in pro-cyclical commodities and potentially causing policy errors. So it's a very confusing backdrop. I got off the sidelines actually yesterday by shorting some Z25 SOFR futures because I just don't think the economy is weak enough to justify, you know, over 225 basis points of cutting.
Thank you for that explanation. Michael, before we get to the presser, I think it would be a huge disservice not to touch on market volatility as a whole, since I brought it up in our intro. Jem, earlier this month, you discussed with Adam Taggart on Thoughtful Money the notion of, quote, more volatility is on the way. And as we've all seen since then, in early September, that's very much been the case. Now, despite a drop from its highs way up at 22.38, VIX is still up 20% on the month, trading in that $17 to $18 range. And to sort of tie this back to my question earlier on equities, what are you seeing in the vol landscape this month? And does that stance of more volatility to come still hold up as we move forward from today?
Absolutely. The reality, if you look at vol microstructure, is that the short-term positive moves we've seen in the market and that beach ball underwater activity, which, you know, those that follow me on Twitter have seen me kind of tweet about and talk about, is incredibly important when you have a big quarterly expiration and a big event. I already highlighted kind of the event vol dynamics that we've just seen. But you take that paired with the Federal Reserve's, again, propensity to try and be aggressive and support the market and make sure, much like it did in December, that it's getting out in front and trying to stimulate before a decline. Those things drive very positive flows. And it's not just into these quarterly expirations and these events. You have a big other vol event sitting out behind it, which you normally don't have in most years, which is a very contested election in November. All of this vol, all of this skew, all of this hedging ultimately drives reflexively more volatility, in particular kind of upside volatility in the market. And there's a tail, to be clear. If the market is to get a big enough move to decline, there is a tinderbox, out of the money in the market that is explosive. But in the absence of it, those flows have to come back in. I would argue that into the end of this year, with the market now up 17%, whatever it is right now, you have a lot of very positive wealth effect flows that drive through beginning of the year reinvestment. You have other flows I've highlighted in depth, which is a very holiday filled and volume weighted time of about 60% of what the rest of the year is once you get to November, December post-election. So the trends here, once you get to the election, are potentially very positive. We've highlighted all year that in election year, this fiscal and monetary stimulus is likely to be present and continue to be present, and that policymakers and the Fed are likely to be overly aggressive than they are usually to make sure they support the market. That is what we have seen. The average election year in a populist cycle, the last eight or seven that we've seen, 21%. I think we're on target for a similar type of outcome to 2020, which again was in line with that in 21%. There's a lot of drivers that will likely take you there. Unlike the rally we saw, we called for in May, June, July, where the market was very, very placid. It's a distant memory to most people now, but we did decline more than 3%. It was like watching paint dry. The summer of Georgia, I called it. That is what happens when you have the opposite flows and reflexively vol dampening. We are now out of that and into a secularly, we believe, increasing vol landscape with skew and lots of risks that sit on the other side of December as well in a January election. So very positive, very volatile, a lot of short interest. Expect more drawdowns and pullbacks in the market, but continued after volatility, beach ball underwater activity that pushes ultimately this market higher into the end of the year. Assuming we get that, I would be very, very cautious January and February of next year.
Before we get to the presser, this one's going to be a panel-wide question that I'm going to kick to Michael first, and then I want everybody's take on this one. Now, it kind of gets into the weeds of correlation versus causation, but it is a question that I see coming up a lot that people even ask me when I think it's pretty clear I'm not the expert on the topic. But when we look back in history with rate cuts, U.S. equities saw double-digit declines after the first rate cuts in 73 and 81 and again in 2001. And there's an outlier in there during the 1982 rate cut cycle where there was just a massive surge a year after of nearly 40%. So my question is now, with rate cuts coming, and again, we hit that 50 bips right out of the gate today, should we expect to see that again, or were other factors really dominating those massive pullbacks following cuts?
Yeah, I think I really do think that the way you pose the question is the right one, causation versus correlation, because in most of those cases where the market sold off, I would say that the Fed was indeed too late and there was a crisis already brewing on the horizon. Like somebody yesterday posted, somebody posed the question, like, has the Fed ever cut with equities at all-time highs? And then somebody showed, 2007, late 2007 as such an example. And I think that's just a spurious example because by summer of 2007, for those of us who lived through that period, there were severe cracks in the credit firmament by then. and that's what caused the subsequent, meltdown in both equities and credit. In this case though, I don't think the current setup is anywhere close to that. I think credit markets are in aggregate quite healthy. And so I'm still of the camp that the Fed is too early here, and this is going to wind up juicing financial conditions in a way that is going to backfire.
Last fair, Joseph, any response to that?
Yeah, I think that it kind of ties into my own personal question about this decision, which is the Fed comfortable, very comfortable with inflation, or are they scared of the macro conditions? And I don't know that I have an answer for it. And I'm not sure what has changed so dramatically, from the prior meeting on either of those fronts. I think that the labor market has, know, there was sort of two pretty poor months of data coming out of the labor market. Inflation has kind of followed the trend for the most part, even though it's ticked up a little bit in the prior report from the shelter, you know, on a core perspective. And I'm not sure. I think that that if, you know, it's a question of whether the rate cuts are, you know, because they feel comfortable with inflation and are looking to stimulate, or because the macro is deteriorating. And I think it's an interesting place right now.
Yeah, sometimes the Fed cuts because things are not doing well, and sometimes the Fed cuts because inflation is coming down. I mean, looking at, for example, in 2020, we had everything tank, Fed cuts. I wouldn't say that there was any causal relationship there. But this time around, you know, as the last bears noted, it seems like macro conditions are benign. Looking at the Fed's projections, they're projecting notable increases in the unemployment rate. So I think what they're doing is trying to get ahead of a recession rather than saying that we're in a recession now. Now, that being said, market is one thing and the economy is another. They're connected, but they're not the same thing. One thing that's standing out to me right now is that the dollar is selling off in a big way. Looking at the Dixie, it looks like it's making year-to-date lows. I'm thinking that if the dollar continues to weaken, the equity market will come under pressure as a lot of foreigners repatriate their holdings to avoid dollar losses. So, you know, market is interesting because the relationships between variables change all the time. The structure changes. So it's really hard to draw inferences from the past. So I think we're going to just have to look at the context and make a judgment.
I think the big thing now is to watch what the other central banks are going to do. And I think the fact that, you know, we have a very dovish Fed doesn't change the fact that I believe the other major economies don't necessarily want to see that weaker dollar. So if this gives their central banks the ability to also match the Fed's aggressiveness in cutting, then we have a very reflationary global sort of competitive cutting cycle.
A lot of beautiful points made as always, but make sure you're following these folks, everybody. Jem Carson, Danny Ives, Michael Cow, Last Bear Standing, and of course, Joseph Wang. And have a great afternoon, everybody.